This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Tom Parker Bowles, is a food critic for the British publications The Mail on Sunday and Tatler. He's also the son of Camilla Parker Bowles, Prince Charles's wife. He spent a year traveling the world in search of culinary extremes, ranging from ultra-hot hot sauce to revolting insects. His new book is called The Year of Eating Dangerously. Tom Parker Bowles, welcome to Fresh Air. What was the premise of your dangerous eating tour?
I think it was a chance, first of all, for me, you know, a greedy person, to travel around the world and eat, to find out all these different food cultures and look within those food cultures at the things that we see as more extreme, perhaps, but within that culture is not at all extreme in any way. So I just wanted to sort of be objective about strange foods. You know, one man's meat is another man's poison, as the cliche goes, but really to get in there, to strip away all those preconceptions of insects and dogs and the rest of it, and, you know, try and see it for what it actually is.
And as you point out in your book, all food is potentially dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, that was another premise, is that, you know, you can see civilization and the sort of the growth of man and the rest of it as you know, a sort of battle against food. You know, fire, refrigeration, preservation, all these things are man's way of trying to control food that obviously rots and does become poisonous. So at the very basic level, all food is dangerous if it goes off. It sounds trite to say that, but you know, this is a thing about all manner of danger in food rather than just, you know, weird, icky bugs and stuff.
Well, speaking of weird icky bugs, let's talk about some. One of the more revolting foods that you ate was silkworm poopie?
Poopie, exactly.
Explain what they are.
Well, they're obviously the unhatched silkworms before, so they look like a sort of a creature out of those alien movies. And the funny thing about it is that they're sold on the street of Korea as children's snacks. The children love them, eat them like candy. So I thought the children can eat them, you know, I can eat them. So I went to go and order them, and they look pretty repellent. And they're quite leathery to start with, and then actually they sort of burst like in your mouth, and this horrible sort of fetid taste comes out. But and it was really genuinely, in a whole year of eating all these sort of weird and wonderful foods, it was one of the only genuinely disgusting things I actually ate. You know, even stripping away the fact this was a bug, the taste for me was repellent. But again, like I say, for the children it was entirely normal, like M&Ms or, you know, Snickers or something.
It was like a street food snack.
Of course, it was a street food, and they'd grown up with it. So growing up with something, they saw it as entirely normal. It was only me who was making the silly faces. And I mean, it's a taste of, as I say in the book, like sort of freshly dug graves. Now, this isn't something that I'd lick a lot, freshly dug graves, but it sort of brought to mind that sort of slight decay, that slight fetidness of the cemetery. It was pretty foul.
Not to gang up on Korea, where you had the silkworm poopie, but also in Korea, you wanted to investigate dog as food. And I mean, this is something that you found very upsetting because you love dogs. But how much is dog part of Korean cuisine? From what I've been reading, it sounds like it's basically an illegal food. It's not regulated.
It's certainly not illegal. It's certainly very much legal. Occasionally, when the Olympics or the World Cup happens, the authorities sort of sweep it under the carpet for a bit, you know, to increase their world image or improve their world image, and then it comes back to normal again. And what my problem was, I didn't have a problem with dog fundamentally. Dog, you know, I love them, I've grown up with them, and I would never eat them as part of my diet. But I was annoyed by the way the West, and especially British tabloids, start screaming at cultures they don't understand, saying, oh, you barbarians, you eat dogs. Well, when we're quite happy to eat intensively farmed pigs and chickens that are brought up in horrible conditions just for cheap meat, you know, I think it's hypocritical to start talking about other cultures. Dog, of course, is more of a medicinal thing in Korea. It's not eaten every day by everyone. It's very expensive, and it's eaten mainly by men and mainly by sort of older men. It's supposed to make you virile and more potent, and it's an aphrodisiac. If you're going to strip everything away, a dog is the same as a cow, as the rest of it. But my problem with the dog was not so much that it was a dog, although I did have idiotic problems with that, but it was the way I found out they were raised. They were raised in the most horrible, inhumane conditions. The organic movement has not hit the dog farming world of Korea yet.
So what dog dish did you end up eating, and how did you feel about it while you were eating it?
The dish I had was called posintang, which is a traditional soup. And it's quite difficult for a Westerner to find dog in Korea, purely because it's not advertised. My Korean reading is obviously absolutely appalling. I can't read the characters. So, and I asked the hotel concierge, who weren't at all impressed, you know. And they were younger. The younger generation don't do it so much. They see it as barbaric and cruel and the rest of it. But in the end, I found something on the internet. Tiny little room off a main street, you know, the size of a sort of small kitchen. And the lady sort of met me wearing a pair of dog slippers, which I wasn't sure whether to take as a joke or something entirely serious. I ordered the soup and it arrived, and it was, you know, it was absolutely fine. It was a big bowl of soup. There was, you know, a stock, lots of chilies, lots of garlic, and lots of sort of, the meat was quite grainy, a little bit gamey, but nothing too bad at all. I started eating it, thought, you know, this is easy. And then at a certain moment, the wind changed, or the air conditioning changed anyway, and this smell came, and it was like that smell of when you take your dogs out for a walk in the rain, you come back and they're wet or damp. And it was like the smell of wet, damp dog, and I'm afraid to say that, you know, my sentimentality took over there. I took one more mouthful and legged it, I'm afraid.
My guest is Tom Parker Bowles, and his new book is called The Year of Eating Dangerously, and it's about traveling around the world for a year eating extreme food. The food that you ate in England was elvers, baby eels. What's extreme or dangerous about the baby eels?
Baby eels or elvers, the eel's the most fascinating creature. You know, it's born, no one's ever seen them reproduce or give birth somewhere in the Sargasso Sea, which is a sort of a weird sort of moving sea, you know, down by Bermuda. Anyway, they float across in the form of mycelium, which is some sort of a sort of leaf-like blob. They float for 2 years across the Atlantic until they hit brackish water by the coast, turn into tiny little wriggling matchsticks, baby eels, and swim up the coast, swim up rivers in Britain, especially the Severn. And in the old days, this used to be a huge local tradition. You know, elver fairs used to happen, and people used to come and catch all these lovely fish. They're delicious tasting, a local delicacy, very delicate with a good texture. But over the years, due to pollution and perhaps a touch of global warming and the filling in of their natural habitats, these elver numbers have gone down and down and down. And of course, there's huge demand for eel from China and Japan. So what's happened now is elvering has become a very, very lucrative business. It's totally cash in hand, so therefore there's not too much tax. And if you imagine, you know, it's almost the sort of same price per gram as gold, these little things you have to catch, with cash bounties on their head and not taxmen and not a lot of law going on down there, it can be a pretty scary place to go. You certainly wouldn't go down there without the right people to the riverbank, you know, with a notepad as a reporter asking stupid questions. So there's this whole underworld behind this sort of slightly genteel veneer of southwest England. There's this sort of underworld. I mean, I hasten to say that 95% is totally legal and above board. It's just that there are a few of the more extreme members of society, I think, who come down looking to make a quick tax-free buck and are not happy if people start sniffing around, really.
So what's dangerous isn't the food. It's the kind of almost black market around the food.
Exactly. And again, like I say, there's not a black market around the food with the people who do it properly. The vast majority do it legally, pay their taxes, and are hardworking fishermen and the rest of it. It's just there is a slight sort of extreme who make it, you know, who do sometimes resort to violence to get people off their pitch.
So what's the taste of the baby eels like?
Well, it's very delicate, has a slight crunch, a very delicately fishy taste. The Spanish are absolutely mad for them. They call them anguillas, and they cook them with chili and garlic, sizzling in an earthenware pot. We traditionally in Britain used to fry bacon, take out the bacon, and then cook the elvers in the bacon fat, and maybe break an egg in as well. So it was a great sort of breakfast dish. But they're very delicate, slightly fishy, sweet, a real, real delicacy, which, you know, sadly, the vast majority of Britain will never be able to eat again. You know, there used to be elver drink, you know, eating competitions and pints of elvers and all the rest of it. And now they're more expensive than caviar and fragua. So they all get rushed off to China and Japan to be farmed into full-size eels.
Now, you came to America for, among other things, the hot sauce. Where does hot sauce fit into your idea of dangerous foods?
Well, this is the whole thing. I've always been a chili freak, a chili fanatic. And, you know, obviously when you're younger, you're, you know, look at this curry I'm eating. It's so hot, it's blowing my head off. Well, you know, yippee-yay. As you get older, you realise that the chili is one of the great fruits of the world. You know, the variety, the versatility, from the fruity heat of the habanero to the smoky warmth of the serrano. You know, all these different flavours and textures, and, you know, in different cuisines all over the world as well. But then again, I thought going to the National Fiery Food Show in Albuquerque, you know, I slightly got it wrong. I slightly thought it was going to be a whole lot of sort of hotheads tasting all these really hot sauces. And actually, it was a very, very highly efficient trade show with all the American chili world there. But I did manage to find some really stupidly hot extract sauces that no person in their right mind would eat. They're more for show. You know, if you think that Tabasco on the SKU, the Scoville heat scale is about 15,000, you're finding sauces here that are 15 million, you know, let's say 15 times hotter than pepper spray. So these are actually far too dangerous for me to try. But I did get a bit drunk a couple of times and sort of tried some of the milder ones that really, really hurt.
Is there anything that puts the flame out?
Well, certainly not water, because as they're oil-based, capsaicin, which is the sort of active ingredient, is water-based. So the best thing to do is a banana or rice or yogurt. The things to sort of smother it and get rid of it, water just spreads it around the mouth. So definitely sort of a banana or rice or something like that.
What did you think of English food when you were growing up?
Well, there's this view in America, and I've been over backwards and forwards for years and years, and every time I speak to Americans, you know, from food lovers to food haters, they say, oh, gee, you know, English food, it must be so bad, so bland. And the problem is that a lot of Americans have tried our institutional food in the service stations, in the supermarkets, in the bad restaurants, and seen English food as dull and stodgy and you know, endless greasy puddings and chips, when actually, you know, great British food is, we've got some of the best produce in the world, and it's just very, very good things cooked simply. A steak cooked rare, just perfectly seasoned with really good chips. Fish and chips is masterful when the fish, you know, the oil's the right temperature, so the fish just steams inside that batter. You have a golden crispy batter and some moist thick flakes of fish within. It's not a highly spiced cuisine. It used to be 200 years ago, very highly spiced, but not so much now. But it's just about really simple seasonal ingredients. And I grew up thinking that British food was absolutely fantastic. You know, you'd be eating, your dad would catch a trout in the river, you'd eat it with potatoes dug up in the garden 20 minutes before with peas picked from the garden. I grew up in a world on a farm, so it was all seasonal, local, almost organic before these words became sort of buzzwords, you know, excuses to charge more money by the supermarkets. So I've always loved English food.
Prince Charles, who is now your stepfather, is into the slow food movement, and that's it's kind of like a regional food movement. The idea is, I'll let you describe the idea.
Well, what slow food was about is started by an absolutely visionary man called Carlo Petrini. What he was saying is, look, you know, this is the joy of eating and the production of food has all become sped up. It's all about making a fast buck. What he wanted to do is go back to artisanal making, and this is all over the world. There are now presidiums of the slow food movement. It's about food, you know. For example, look at the difference between an intensely farmed chicken that takes only a few weeks to go from chick to slaughter, and it's pumped artificially with all sorts of hormones and sort of antibiotics and the rest of it, and it's just a product. Whereas he's going back saying, why not choose an old-fashioned breed that is made for the area, that grows slowly, but it has the most fantastic meat? Or the same with a pig. Why not use a Gloucester Old Spot or a Lop or a Tamworth, which are British native pigs? They do take longer. They do take more time and money to produce, but at the end of it, the animal's happier and the person eating at the end is happier. So it's about food being produced, not fast-produced food and mass-produced food, but slowly-produced food like it used to be done. And also he talks about the joys of the table, you know, the joy of a Saturday, sitting with friends, having a six-hour lunch. You don't have to be drunk all the way through it. It's about sitting down and letting, you know, really just taking a break from this sort of really, really fast, the fast pace of the modern world. And it's a fantastic movement. It's trying to negate all this, you know, this new movement of mass industrialization and cares more about taste than a quick profit.
Is this now something that you and Prince Charles have in common that you can share?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he's a man who you know, 10, 15 years ago, he was talking about the advantages of organic farming, of sustainable farming, of buying locally, of buying seasonally. And of course, you know, at the time, everyone was saying he was mad. Now, of course, he's been totally, you know, justified in what he said. He was absolutely spot on and way, way ahead of his time. He knows a huge amount about farming, about the way food is produced, and he cares, you know, very, very deeply about the British farmer and actually about the, you know, the state of the environment across the world. So people might sit and criticise him, but I wouldn't hear a word against him on, you know, at all.
If you don't mind my asking, and if you do mind, just tell me, how did it change your life when the tabloids picked up, or Andrew Morton in his book picked up that your mother and Prince Charles were having an affair, and then, you know, boom, spotlight on your family?
Sure. I mean, people often say, you know, it must have been hard and seeing your mother and being attacked and abused and all the rest of it. But my sister and I have, you know, we've always been pragmatic about it. We've had the most privilege it's possible for any children to have. We've had an entirely idyllic childhood. And, you know, sometimes you wish you could have some horror story saying how awful it was. But my parents, to both of us, were perfect parents. So by the time we were 18, 17, 18, this happened. Sure, there were days when people were a bit rude and the rest of it. But, you know, we could have been, you know, this isn't difficult. We could have been born in a slum. We could have been abused. We could have been born in a war zone. We could have been born with no parents. So putting everything into context, nothing was difficult and nothing really changed at all. You just shrug it off and get on with it. My parents have always been very good to both of us, and they're still friends. That's all that mattered to me, my parents being happy, and I suppose selfishly us being happy as well. You know, people say we were affected by this. No, we had a very secure family and good friends, so that kept us going through it.
Prince Charles is in line to become king. If your mother becomes queen, like, how would that affect your life?
I don't think it'd be any different from my life now, actually. We might see her a little less, but it wouldn't. You know, my sister and I were married. I've got a child coming in a week, touch wood. My sister's pregnant. We have our own lives, you know. We don't live around our mother. Of course it's a pleasure to go and see her and my stepfather, as it is to go and see my father and my stepmother, but we have our own lives now, so it doesn't make much difference to our life at all.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Tom Parker Bowles is the author of the new memoir, The Year of Eating Dangerously.